Radio Gorgeous, where women do the talking.
I'm going to ask you a little bit about yourself first.
Okay.
Because I think that is somewhat integral to the story of Among the Hoods. But so you're a think tank report writer.
Yeah, I do. I do investigations for a right of center think tank called the Center for Policy Studies. And I also write comment pieces for the Daily Mail and the Sunday Times. And then my think tank reports have all been serialized in the Daily Mail. And I write reports about, I've done the police, immigration, the care system, and why Black Caribbean and white working class boys fail.
And it's fair to say, as you said, right of center.
Yeah.
So it's fair to say conservative, etc.
Yes.
So this book, Among the Hoods, is the story of your 3-year friendship.
Oh, it's long gone on longer.
Yeah.
It's still going.
I'm really glad to hear that. I was going to ask you that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But tell us how you came to be friends with Swagger and then meet this gang of teenage boys.
Well, I was doing this report on why Black Caribbean and white working class boys fail. So I was going around all over the country, interviewing, you know, white boys in Newcastle, Liverpool. And I'd sort of done quite a lot of interviews, and I wanted to come down to Brixton and interview some black gangs. And I met Swagger at a community centre. And he said, you really don't think it's a good idea if you wander around South London picking up black teenagers. So he said, I'll come with you. So we had a great day, just really going around picking up boys. And then towards the end, he said, you know, there's this gang that always hang around outside my local chicken takeaway. You know, let's go and talk to them. So we arrived, and we were on the other side of the street, and I looked across the street, and there were these group of boys. And frankly, they looked terrifying. They were about 15 or 16. You know, their jeans were hanging down, they wore hoodies, they were shouting, they were aggressive, they were sort of bumping into passers-by, catching cigarettes, and they looked capable of anything. I mean, you know, I'm sure that they had a knife or a gun or something.
Seriously intimidating.
Yeah, and as a sort of white, middle-class, middle-aged woman, I mean, all I wanted to do was just, you know, go on walking down my side of the street and not draw attention to myself. Mm-hmm. But Swagger said, come on.
Tucking your pocketbook
yeah,
close
that's
to your
right.
body. And,
Swagger said, come on, you've got to talk to these boys. And he went off across the road, and I didn't want to. I thought, oh my God. But anyway, I followed Swagger and started talking to them. And it was really the best thing I've ever done.
Yeah. And so tell me about the leader, Tuggy Tug.
Well, when we started talking, Tuggy Tug, who was the smallest, but he pushed himself in front of the others and was obviously their leader and was really funny and very articulate, said a whole lot of stuff to me I was not expecting to hear. And I was, you know, I was just charmed because they were intelligent. They thought a lot about things that really we take for granted. I mean, something like love, family, and a future were not a given in their lives. And so I found that even though I found it difficult to understand a lot of what they said, Swagger had to sort of do a translation job because they didn't understand me. So, yeah. You know, he was doing this translation job. But I was really surprised and moved by them.
Yeah, and Swagger was sort of your interpreter / guide.
Yes, yeah.
And you did really need an escort.
Beginning, yes. Yeah. Because Tuggy Tug, I went back a few months later because by this point I'd been interviewing some white gangs about crime. So I thought it'd be quite fun to go back and interview Tuggy Tug and get their views. So I went back with Swagger And Tuggy Tug came bounding up the road. He's totally pleased to see us, so that surprised me. And then I said, well, you know, what have you been doing? They said, ooh, we've been doing the shooting and the stabbing. And they were sort of hunching up their shoulders and look aggressive. But I have to say, they were about 15 at that point, and I have a teenage son who at that was their age. And I know that my teenage sons are always very hungry at that point. And I thought they looked a bit peaky. So I said, are you hungry? And immediately all the bravado vanished. And they said, oh, we're always hungry. So I was really shocked by this. And
you found, you know, after you went and fed them, I mean, you found...
Well, I then took Tuggy Tug. I said, come on, I'll take you out. So he chose two friends who much later on I discovered he charged £5 each, for including. He's a great entrepreneur.
He really is.
And I took them off to Nando's. And then they immediately opened up. They told me a lot about their life. And I was really quite shocked and upset about what was happening to them.
What preconceptions did you come with? And what did you... then find
well,
it like
sure
about
I
their
had any
care.
Preconceptions, but one thing I was not expecting. I was not expecting that, you know, we spend a lot of money, the state spends a lot of money taking care of these boys, I thought. And I was not expecting that 15-year-old boys in this country would be hungry. I wasn't expecting Tuggy Tug was actually in care. Two of them are from the care system. And I wasn't expecting that they would be just sort of abandoned in this awful hostels with sort of ex-murderers and drug dealers and everyone else living in the same place and just left to no cooking facilities, no money, and just left to get on with it on something like, I think it's about £45 a week. Well, you know, I at that point had a very, I mean, I still have a very motivated, competitive son who's, you know, never had any problems with his schoolwork, nothing like that. But, you know, how many of us sort of middle-class parents would leave our 15 or 16-year-olds in a hostel on their own, expect them to get up at the right time in the morning, make their own breakfast, get themselves to school every day, buy their food on the way home, make themselves dinner, put themselves to bed at the right time. You know, if a whole lot of friends turn up, say, no, I can't come and party tonight, I've got to do my homework. I don't think any of us would.
No.
And yet we were expecting this from the most sort of vulnerable kids who had
never had an example of that anyway.
Exactly, exactly. So I was really distressed at how he was living. I was distressed because he took me back, you know, as we got more and more friendly and I went back and saw his hostel. He showed me all these letters from social workers who were meant to look after him, which were just disgusting. I mean, they just would come into his life and say, I'm your new social worker. 6 months later, he rarely saw them. He would just get a text occasionally. They'd say, oh, and now I'm leaving. I'm going on to this next initiative, or I'm retiring, or whatever.
So already by the second time you showed up and took him to Nando's, you had already showed up more in his life.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
anybody.
I hadn't thought about that, yeah, but yes, true. And I think, I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. And I have to admit, you know, I have not been successful, not too successful with these boys. But I soon discovered, as, you know, as the years went by, the one thing I had in my favor, it was that I was a fixture in their lives. And
you showed up.
I showed
and
up.
And you kept showing up.
And frankly, that was so extraordinary. And that was just so pathetic that made me unusual in their lives.
From his early life, he was taken into care. He didn't remember anything before he was 5. And he did have a wonderful...
He had a great foster mother who I'm in touch with, who's, you know, really worried about him and rings me up. And she goes to church a lot and she's always praying to God to send an angel. So at one point she was hopeful I was that angel, but we've not, you know, he's unfortunately he's not really changed his life.
But those years from 5 to 12 and you are the two people in his life.
Yes. And then he, after that, he was dragged from her because the council announced she had to retire. So he and I think it was his sister, his little sister, mm-hmm. were forcibly dragged from the... Can you imagine this happening to an 11-year-old? That they are forcibly removed from their only mother, the woman they consider their mother. And we think this is fine. Yeah. I cannot believe the cruelty. And you must remember I did a whole report on the care system. So I know that this is not unusual. This has happened to a lot of the kids I interviewed. And so he was dragged away, screaming and hitting. He said, you know, we put up a good fight. And not, that's such a key point, just before adolescence, it's not sort of surprising that his behavior then deteriorated quite dramatically.
Yeah. So it seems to, because what you saw was systemic failure from that early care system. His parents were crack addicts or drug addicts or what have you. So he was... All five of their children were eventually taken from them.
Well, that was another thing I found extraordinary about them. Yes, I mean, there's five children, and the first three were all taken into care. So you'd think, you come along to Tuggy Tug's number four, you'd think by number four that the social services would think, oh, well, maybe it's not a good idea we leave him with her. Maybe we could get him adopted. And if he had been adopted as a baby, he would have been a different person. I mean, he'd probably be a very sort of successful entrepreneur by now.
Yeah, because he was so...
Paying taxes, so employing people, and instead of being a burden on the system.
So there was two drivers there. One, because I also remember that his sister, there was a woman that wanted to adopt his sister, but it was like, no, siblings stay together, was one thing. And also, if he were put up for adoption, only a black family was allowed to adopt him.
Yeah, I don't think Tuggy Tug, frankly, would have... You know, when sitting in a cell, prison cell at 18... I wonder whether he might have swapped that for a bit of sort of cultural...
Racial confusion, as they put it. Yeah. Okay, so the care system failed him, and then school fails them.
Then school fails. I mean, this is the next thing that really shocked me. And also, again, I was doing this report. So you've got to remember that while I was seeing these boys, I was also doing all this research. Nearly all the boys, whether black or white, same problem, that their state schools had failed to teach them to read and write. And, I mean, again, the statistics, when you look on this, are truly shocking. I mean, we must forget, it is not difficult to teach a kid to read and write. And a lot poorer countries than us, who spend a lot less money, seem to do it fine. But you have a third of black, Caribbean and white working class boys at the age of 14 have a reading age of a seven-year-old. This is just appalling, and appalling that no one notices or does anything about it. They start behaving badly in primary school. They then hit secondary school, and they're humiliated because they can't understand what's going on in class. They may be bright, but if you can't read or you're reading shaky, that's the end of you, really. And they start dropping out because the only way that they can impress their peers, which is so vital for boys at that age, is by behaving badly. Mm-hmm. So Tuggy Tug complained to me, they all said to me, there's no discipline in the school. And I was slightly astonished that they said, there's no point going into school because the teachers don't care about us. That's what they said. Mm-hmm. The teachers don't discipline us. They don't care about us. And we don't learn anything. So they dropped out. And at 14, were drug dealing and committing crime.
Yeah. And the thing is, the drug dealing is very, very compelling.
Very compelling.
It doesn't, I mean, and how are you going to compete that? It doesn't affect their benefits. You have prestige. You have money. It breaks up the monotony of their lives.
That's so true. It's so true. I mean, one of the things I realized is how bored they are. These boys are seriously bored. They are hanging around on a street corner. I mean, they are so bored that when a middle-aged white woman like me comes along and says...
Usually invisible, in the rest of life.
Hey, I say, come and see the Imperial War Museum. They've never been to a museum. And they are so bored that they will come. Well, I think any mother of a 15-year-old boy will appreciate how extraordinary that is.
Instead of the eye rolling and
that's
like,
right.
Please.
I wouldn't be seen dead with you anywhere.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Not only did he not know how to get the benefits that he was actually entitled to, and for him, money and love were equated. So you know, in lieu of one, he should have at least had the other.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. He didn't even know. I mean, he was a child brought up by the state. But because I said to them, as you know, the years went past and they reached sort of, I can't remember now, when they were about 17 or 18, I said, right, you've got to get a job. This is ridiculous. You can't go on like this. And they were involved with the criminal justice system at that point. And so I said, we're going off to the job centre. So they were utterly against going to the job centre. They said, it's a horrible place. The people are horrible. So I said, no, we're going to the job centre. And I had to bribe them. I had to give Tuggy Tug £30 to go to the job centre with me. And I was surprised, because I was surprised that they were not drawing benefits. But they explained to me that they would be... I mean, that was another reason they didn't want to turn up in the job centre, because it's so humiliating.
Yeah.
They said, anyone who sees us thinks that we need to go to the job centre to get whatever it is, you know, £50, shows that we can't make our own money on the street. We don't want people thinking that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a sign of a loser.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I want to reassure taxpayers out there that they're not on benefits. Anyway, and also I want to reassure taxpayers that it's really difficult to get on benefits, because we then went there and there was me and Swagger, and there was two of the other boys and
Smalls,
and Tuggy Tug and Sunshine, that's right, I think it's Sunshine, Smalls and Tuggy Tug, and just to get him on, you have to phone up and they ask questions. You see, they say, what's your name? Well, Tuggy Tug would have given up on the third question, because they asked him, what's his title? He had no idea what that was.
Yeah.
And then he said, oh, that's what they're going at. So then we went on to the next question, which was when he spelt out his name, and they spelt it back, saying, you know, using Papa Brava. He had no idea what that was. He thought that the man was taking the mickey out of him, and he would have just, you know, walked off. So that is the level of ignorance.
Yeah.
They are so outside mainstream life. And I think we, and also, you know, they don't use computers. I mean, they obviously do games, mm-hmm. but the idea of composing an email.
Yeah. Forget about it. Yeah. And any
like
of these
that.
Skills.
No idea.
And so, you know, but so where does all our money go? Because we put a lot of money into it. Where does it go?
Well, I think it goes, one of them's... I can't remember if it was Tuggy Tug or Swagger said to me, one of them said, I think Tuggy Tug, he said, I don't need another social worker. He said, I need a social worker's wage.
Yeah.
And then the other thing one of them said to me was, you know, all these little jobs like the police, the prison, probation, social workers, teachers, you know, where would they be if us black boys didn't keep failing? Mm-hmm. So they very strongly feel that all this money is going to the kind of middle class people who have these jobs, who are overseeing their failure.
Right.
That's where they feel the money's
going. So there's a vested interest in keeping them failing, to keep the system going.
But the money's going to the carers. It's not going to the cared for.
Right.
I'll have to say, by the end of my experience with them, I began to feel that. I mean, I sort of went in as sort of Anne Widdecombe, and I've come out an anarchist. I mean, I was so appalled. I spent 3 days. I spent a number of times in that job centre, but that was 3 days on that particular occasion, and I was so shocked.
And all they seemed to focus on how a teenager owed rent arrears as well. And how, I mean, I just don't understand how that
I never understood got to the bottom of that. But I mean, first of all, I thought a job centre was about jobs and training. No, not a word. It was about benefits. All they wanted to do is get those kids on benefits. Those boys did not want to be on benefits. They actually wanted to be independent.
They wanted a job.
They are absolutely desperate to be financially independent, especially Tuggy Tug. There was no, I mean, at the end of 3 days, all we got was a website, to go and look on a website, and that was all. I said, wait a sec, what about training? What about, you know, apprenticeships? Nothing like that at all. Just this one website, which I then went, and, you know, Tuggy Tuck had long since, he just wandered off, he was fed up with the whole thing. And on the website, there was no jobs. There was no, I went into building, no building jobs. And I thought, this is crazy. Of course there's building jobs. Of course there's catering. And then I rang up a friend of mine who runs a restaurant, a string of restaurants. And he said, oh, yeah, I get all my workers from Gumtree. I never go near a job centre. And he said, they're all foreign. He said, you know, Mexican are the flavour this week.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's another thing, because you have studied immigration. I'm going to just do a little
yeah, sorry,
tangent
we've
here.
We've gone.
That's all right. Yeah, we're going to meander. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no, yeah. We're going to meander because this is all really fascinating. But so where immigration comes into it, because Swagger's parents, immigration worked for them.
Yes, but I tell you where immigration comes into it is because Swagger's parents went to very good traditional schools in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And the thing about immigration is, I find this quite extraordinary. Left-wingers, they all love immigrants while they're coming over to this country. But the moment they settle in this country and have children, they go off them. So, you know, over and over again, I read that, our young people don't want to take jobs. They don't want to work hard. They're not qualified. Well, how can you put immigrants through our appalling state school system? They come out the other side and then you turn on them and say, you're not qualified. No, they're not. Mm. Because our state school, and the great thing that immigrants have over people like Tuggy Tug is they haven't been through our state school system.
Right. And so they're coming over, they're educated.
They're educated.
And they're motivated.
They're motivated.
And they can do, they have the computer skills, they have the social skills they have. So they're getting the jobs that these kids could be doing.
These kids are
if
being
we had trained them.
Hammered.
We'd be forced to educate them if we didn't have
other people taking the jobs. These kids are being hammered by our bad state schools. And by immigration. I mean, this is sort of a double whammy that's hitting them.
Yeah. Okay. And do you think that was what... Because,
I mean, sorry, can I just make a point here that Swagger made to me? Where he said, I say, look, everyone says you're not motivated. And he said, he said he'd actually watched a program about how he was at that point trying to get a job on a train station. He was told that, only Polish... workers, they were only keen on taking Polish workers. They weren't interested in Swagger. And the Polish workers on a minimum wage could, back in Poland, build themselves a really nice four-bedroom house with a garden and even send their kids to the equivalent of private school in Poland. And in fact, my Polish builder did this. Mm-hmm. And he said...
Swagger in South London couldn't possibly do.
Swagger said, if I, on a minimum wage, could buy a house in South London, send my children to private school, well, I'd be working all hours.
You did finally find a solution, because Tuggy Tug really had thought it out and did the numbers.
Yeah.
And he was given a great example by a... an older man who had been with the Krays, Bobby Cummins.
Cummins. Who helped him more than any of these social workers.
He broke it down in such a great model.
That was extraordinary, that whole thing. I unfortunately couldn't get him a job at that point when he was so... And then when I did get him a job, I actually did finally manage to get him, because he's very interested in being a chef. And I did manage to get, and by then it was too late, which was really sad.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but, and also you had found, Tuggy Tug had done the math. He said, if I could get a certain amount, and not pay tax, if I could get, so I'd be saving this and I could live on that and I could, I wouldn't be paying taxes, if I could get that.
He was all,
And you're like, awesome, I found it, Skills Academy. And then they were shut down in 2010.
Yes, Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, no, that was a really sad, And then when I did find him a job, by then he'd sort of gone to prison already. Mm-hmm. It was all.
But in prison, there was,
Prison was, that was another
that
revelation.
That was a miraculous turnaround for him.
That was another revelation. So I thought, prison, they're going to, Tuggy Tug's going to, I have to go and visit Tuggy Tug. It was all awful. I was terribly upset when he went, because it just seemed like the end of everything. And I thought, oh, God, he's going to be miserable. And then I tried to go visit him. And I have to tell you that trying to visit someone in prison is not easy. Because
you couldn't even find him.
Well, I couldn't find... At first, I couldn't find him. And that was really hard. And then the prison visitors line was always engaged. It was so difficult to get... Finally, I actually wrote to the governor and said, look, you know, your website says that visiting's a good plan. Just can you please tell me how I get to visit? So it was a bit like having a son at boarding school, and the governor was great, and I actually really liked the governor. But and I finally got to get to see Tuckerton, and you know, when you go in, it's rather like going on an aeroplane. You get everything, you get searched, you have to open your mouth so they can search if you've got drugs and pick up your feet so they can look at your feet and all of this. So finally I go in then, there's Tucky Tuck. And I think I was feeling pretty flattened by the whole experience of getting into this prison. So I assumed he'd be completely sort of steamrolled. Not at all. He was sitting there, bursting with vitality and health. And he was really, I don't say he was enjoying prison, but he was pretty happy because, and I think this is where, you know, again, left wing and right wing just get it so wrong. Because what they don't understand is that the I think it's about half of all young people under the age of 25 in prison have been through the care system. And so from someone like Tuggy Tug, his life had been so miserable that when he got to prison, it was a relief. First mm-hmm. of all, he's getting to see a doctor and a dentist. He'd never seen a doctor and dentist before.
He had never seen a dentist.
No. Because, and I discovered this through in the care thing when I was doing my research, there was a little note that said that, there's a very low take up of children in care going to see a dentist. And that was because it's against their human rights to force them to see a dentist, which to me is such a sort of, you know, as a mother, you know, your child doesn't want to go to see the dentist, but as
so
part
what?
Of
you're
being
going.
A mother,
yeah, you're going.
Take them to the dentist. And I thought that would just said so much about the care system.
Radio Gorgeous supports women. Women support Radio Gorgeous.
So, so Tuggy Tug, I remember having to explain to him about dental floss because his gums were bleeding, couldn't understand it. Anyway, so there he was. And first of all, he put on weight for the first time. He was always very small.
He had 3 meals a day.
Yeah, and he'd suddenly grown because he was having these 3 meals a day. He said he was very proud. He said, I've got this really organised day. I get up in the morning, I go to the gym, I then have my 3 meals, I then go and get a job. He said, Harry, I know you tried to get me a job and we failed, but in prison I've got a nice little job. And then in the afternoon he was doing some studying so he could get qualifications for being a chef. Then he had a game of football, and then he went to bed.
So this is exactly, you know, what he had needed, the structure.
Exactly. It would have been a lot cheaper and easier if we just put Tuggy Tug into a boarding school at age 11 or 12, mm-hmm. rather than just let him live on the streets, wreck his life, and then at 18, when it's too late, give him that structure that he so desperately wanted and appreciated.
Well, for him and his friends and his gang, one, they were the only family really they had.
Yes, that's a very good point.
You know, and two, the options are prison or death.
Yeah, I'm afraid, you know, that's. I mean, when I did at one point ask them, because they was talking about death, and which I again found compared to my fifth son and his friends, they never talk about death. But he's always. So I wonder. I said, well, all right, you're always talking about death. Well, how many of your friends have died? And they counted off four. And I have to say, I then went and checked online because you can go into local newspapers and that was true.
It struck me also, you know, when you couldn't find him in prison at first. They were like, oh, no, there's no record of him.
Yeah.
And even when you went to visit him, they're like, nope, there's nobody. You could see him.
Yeah,
the door, they're like, nobody of that name. And it struck me, well, what if he had died in prison?
You know, that's such a good point because...
You know, who would they tell? Who would... would anyone know?
Well, that's such a good point. And I don't think I really appreciated that until Smalls went to prison. And Smalls is huge and very frightening. And you know, when I first met the boys, I was always a bit frightened, intimidated by Smalls. But then he was so sweet. And I got very fond of him. And he went to prison and he was never You know, he was always, he was never frightened about anything. And I said to him once, you know, because he'd been to Feltham very early on and had actually, I think he'd grown something like 7 or 8 inches because for the first time he'd got proper meals in Feltham. And I said, well, you know, were you worried? And he said, no, because there's not much anyone can do to someone like me. He said, well, but yeah, then, and having said that, he then, I'm afraid, I don't know what he did in prison. I think there was a riot and he was involved. I mean, I don't even like to think. But he was then sent up to, which is often what they do with troublemakers, he was sent up north. And he was in a prison near Wales, I think. And he was obviously one of the only black boys and one of the only boys from London up there. And he suddenly, I got a letter from him, or a phone call from him saying he was about to turn 18 and he was a bit worried about going, because then he would be moving into the kind of the big man's prison. Mm-hmm. And he was anxious about that. He was anxious that all these Liverpool scousers, he said, were going to just have to prove themselves because he was so big.
Exactly. And he's the, you know, he's the one to beat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suddenly thought about this and I thought, he's got nobody, no family or anything else. And if something happened to him in prison, who was going to know? Who was ever going to ask about it? He could so easily just have died in prison and
disappeared.
And so I then wrote a letter to the governor saying that he was concerned about, you know, being racially attacked and asking what they planned to do about it and saying I was going to come up and visit him. And the next thing I discovered, he'd been moved back to London.
The power of the middle-aged lady.
just the fact I was, was someone.
Someone was interested.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's amazing. Even it just normal human psychology. If someone in the hospital, if you have two people in two hospital beds and one of them gets visited and the other one doesn't, well, the nurses pay more attention to the one who gets visited.
Yeah.
You know, it's awful, but it's true. And also, let's make no mistake, they were robbing people and beating them up.
I do not want to be sentimental about this because...
No, this is very real.
And I have never quite reconciled my... Because I my parents were victims of a crime. They were robbed outside their house and the young boy with a knife cut my mother's hands and my father was knocked unconscious.
And it's traumatizing.
Yes, it was very
seriously traumatizing.
Yeah, and I know sort of at first hand what it's like to be a victim, and I hate crime. And Tuggy Tug, I actually went to one of his sentencings, and he was sentenced for committing over 100 robberies during the period that I knew him. So I have very mixed feelings about this, which I have never really got to the really reconciled or got to the bottom of. But
I don't think you can. You know, I mean, it's incredibly complex. Mm.
I mean, he certainly deserved to go to prison, and he. But I just think it would have been a lot easier if we'd done something about him a lot earlier.
I was really fascinated by the book, and it was really well written as well, because there's a sense of suspense, and you do fall in love with the characters, you know. Mm. But these are real people, and like you say, with very complex issues. And a lot of people would have been very repelled. And one of the characters that was quite a scary thought was Dimples. And here's a young girl who had been in a girl gang, and she really enjoyed the violence.
Yeah, that was absolutely fascinating because the boys would never talk to me about what they were doing. And I have to say, the boys were always very well-behaved around me.
Yeah, they never cursed, and there was a total etiquette.
Yes,
You know, it might have been a different one, but there was a total adhered to etiquette.
I mean,
etiquette.
They had a very strong morality. It was just not happened to be not our morality.
Yes. It's included robbery. And,
But the girl... And I, because I did at one point interview quite a lot of girls for another report I did. But, you know, she was sort of cuddling up to me in this car. I was interviewing her in the car. She was cuddling up to me and then telling me about all the sort of violence that she did in vivid detail.
And stomped on her face.
Yes. And I mean, and I'm always trying to be empathetic when I'm interviewing someone like you're being now. But I just... sort of was lost for words. I didn't know how to be empathetic.
Okay.
Well, yes, you know, I also love stabbing people on the face. I didn't know what to say.
But in how she got out of it, and unfortunately, they all seem to be entrapped by the system was by having a kid.
Yeah, that's something else. Again, I did this report on girls, on bad girls, and I think that the girls are just as much victims of a failing education system as
and
the
just
boys.
Just as bored.
And the boys take to crime, but the girls, the only way that they can become independent adults, just as the boys take to crime to become independent adults, is by having a baby. Because then, again, it's not stupid. I think this is a perfectly sensible financial decision.
Yeah.
They see that if they have, say, two children, that they will then get the same amount of money from the state as having a low-paid job.
And they get a place to live.
So this is and most of them are trying to escape the situation. I mean, all the ones I interviewed, because they're young single mothers. They are not getting on with. They're not getting on with their mother's boyfriends or whatever. They're desperate to get out of the house. And so that's what they do.
Yeah.
And I just, again, you know, think it's... And the men, I mean, men like Swagger were really, really upset about it, because they said, you know, we are not given the opportunity to be a husband because
or
these
father.
Women, or yeah, because these women, the state has come, both the husband and the employer,
yeah,
and it's taken it away from us. And a lot of these men in their 30s and 40s that I interviewed actually thought this was a kind of white conspiracy by the government to deprive black men of the chance of being husbands and fathers, which, you know, again, you talk to someone left wing, they've never thought of that. So I was just, you know, fascinated, all these preconceived ideas we have.
Yeah, and and also mixed in with this, I mean, your life is continuing. Your son, you know, also sort of parallel to Tuggy Tug, is growing up.
I think that's why I felt so strongly about the gang, because they're the same age as my son and his friends, and I could see how my son and Tuggy Tug, you know, started out 15, both sort of bright, ambitious. They both liked hanging around on the street with their friends. This is a thing that young males like to do. But my son is very fortunate that he went to a really good private school in London, and his school took all the things that he wanted and used them in a good way. For instance, he played rugby. So he and his friends made this little band playing rugby together, and were exhausted and worked very hard, very proud of their success. And Tuggy Tug and his friends weren't given that opportunity at school. So they made a gang. And, you know, a gang is simply a sort of kind of mirror image of the sort of house system in a private school.
Yeah.
I mean, there is nothing more hierarchical or structured or competitive or full of activity than a gang. So, you know, if you don't give them that, they will create it themselves.
I mean, whereas your sons were, you know, harnessed that energy for good.
Yeah.
You know, whereas, you know, Tuggy Tug's wolf pack went feral.
That's right.
You know, basically.
Exactly.
You know,
That's exactly it.
Wild. And so where is Tuggy Tug now?
Well, Tuggy Tug is out from prison for the moment. And he suddenly, I got a phone call from him just like 2 weeks ago. And he said that all his, because I see them quite regularly, because I see Tuggy Tug and Mash. Unfortunately, Smalls is in prison at the moment, but Tuggy Tug and Mash are out. So I'm seeing Mash on, my birthday's on Monday, so he's coming along to see me. So that's really nice. Anyway, he rang me up and he said that there was a taxi coming up from South London. But the taxi was coming up to South London with his clothes. This taxi arrived and I had to carry out three huge bags of clothes. I had to carry upstairs, you know, 21 boxes of trainers. I mean, I can...
Oh my God.
I can show them. I've got the trainers stacked up under my children's rocking horse on the top floor. And I said, why are you sending me your clothes and trainers? And he said, well, I've got an important meeting. I said, Tuggy Tug, what kind of meeting is it that you're going without any clothes or trainers? And of course, the really sad thing is, he may be going back to prison. Right. And he wants to
a place to
safe, because his trainers are really you know, important to him. His clothes are really important to him. So he wants a place of safety to leave them.
Oh, yeah.
So I've got them at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. But at least, you know where they are. And you have remained constant in his life. And when he went to prison, it was the first time he was around adult males.
Yeah, that's another reason they like prison, because it's the first time. And they say, oh, you get to have these really interesting conversations. Because when they reach 18, they go to sort of, you know, big proper prison. They like talking to adult males, which again is so sad.
So you're going to Parliament, I mean, how is this affecting your life?
It's making me very angry. Because I was, you know, when I wasn't doing that, I was going along to think tank meetings. I was going along, you know, my whole life was going, was continuing. And I actually became completely obsessed. I mean, my friends got really bored. Every article I wrote was, you know, saying, this is what's going on. And I got really, really angry about what was happening to these boys. Because, and it wasn't just these boys, it was all the other boys I was meeting and interviewing. Because I did meet, probably two out of all of them, who I thought were I'm seriously glad they're in prison, locked away, and I don't ever want to come up against them in a dark night. But that was very rare. But the majority of these young boys were perfectly, potentially decent, hardworking young people who've just had their lives blighted, wasted. Mm. And there's no good reason for it. And it really makes me angry.
And what's the solution?
I think the schools has to be where, because this is where they spend the most amount of time.
The
youngest age. This is the one place we can make a serious difference. And I have to say, Michael Gove has got so much stick from the educational establishment, but he is shocked by what is happening to these kids, and he wants something done about it. And what I think is really shocking is that our educational establishment is not shocked. You know, why are they not saying, oh my God, it's not working? And instead they say, oh, it's their background. But that's not good enough. I mean, school should be where we change things, and we can change things. And I was talking to someone yesterday who's trying to set up a kind of, boarding schools for boys from a poor background. And I think, you know, somebody like Tuggy Tug would have benefited hugely from that.
Mm. But yeah, the problem is that I was thinking about, okay, what kind of solutions do you have? But as soon as you bring in, you know, if there's one problem there, if there's one pedophile who works in that school, then system gets torn down. And it's like, oh.
Yeah, because I was talking to, I have a friend who actually works in a pupil referral unit where the toughest kids get sent. And he was saying, oh, you know, if only we could have a boarding school out in the country, or get them away from London. But I said to him, they made that very point. I said, the trouble is when you have a closed community like a boarding school is, you don't know what's going to be happening in there. And very few people believe these kids. I mean, we saw this in the care homes.
Yeah.
But this friend of mine who would like to start a boarding school in London. And I think that's quite a good idea. And it'd be a weekly so that they'd go home at weekends. Mm-hmm. Because then anyone can walk in there and check what's going on, and it's the trouble is that it does mean they're still in that area. So, but
you know, there's not a silver bullet.
There's not exactly,
and perhaps that could start changing and incorporating. And if it is in the area, then you can see there's another way.
Yeah,
because that's what the thing. There was no way. Mm. There was no way out. For the smart, for the you know, ones who could read, the ones who couldn't, you know, for any of them.
But this I mean, you know, everyone makes this huge fuss about gangs, but this is what is causing gangs.
Yeah. And yeah, so it's just tell me what, when the violence erupted a couple of summers ago, what did it make you think?
Oh, well, because mine were all taking part, you know, and I was sort of ringing them up and saying, what are you doing? No, you cannot go in there. Get back home.
Get out there. Put that merchandise down. This instant.
But the interesting thing was, I remember talking to Mash, and he was just standing outside one of the, you know, trainer, I can't remember which one, you know, strung the train shop. And he was not running in to go and pick the trainers up. What was fascinating, more amazing than the looting, was the fact, he said, you know, and I have to preface saying that, you know, people like me, you know, we were all locked in our houses, not going out. But for him, it was the opposite. This was the first day he could move freely round his own city. He said all the other gangs that usually is so territorial. See, I would have to always drive down and pick them up. They couldn't move over.
Yeah, like a 3-block radius. Their whole lives were in. And if you went outside of that, that's some other gang's territory you'd be jumped.
Yes, and you could be murdered or whatever. Yeah. And he said, no, well, we've decided not. We're all sort of just decided that the feds, the police are the only enemy and we're not going to. And he just couldn't believe it. He said, I can go anywhere I like today.
It's a wonderful summer's evening.
It's lovely. Woo, he was so
fantastic.
Happy. Yeah, he was really.
Oh my God. Again, not something that.
Not something.
We would even know or would occur to us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I found so fascinating that I suddenly saw the way. And of course, they think the way we think is so extraordinary.
Alien.
Yeah, so alien to them. So, I mean, one of the things I found fascinating is they said to me, but we thought you lot, meaning me, you all knew what was being done to us by the education, by the job centres. We thought you knew and that you agreed with it. Mm. And I said, no, we certainly don't know. And I explained from our side, we pay our taxes. We thought that you're taken care of. And and they were so amazed at how shocked and angry I was.
Yeah, they were like, we told you, Harry man.
We told you. And, maybe you should do an anger management course. So I went out and shouted at them, whoever. She should do that. I might have done it because they've always been sent on anger management courses. But so they were all amazed. But they were also pleased because, and they are there again, this sort of resentment against sort of white middle class people is because they think we all know and agree with it and connive in it.
Yeah.
So that was another thing that was very revealing.
Yeah. Well, Harriet Sargent, you have been so generous with your time. I really appreciate it.
Not at all.
What's next for you? What are you working on?
Well, Tuggy Tug's cousin, who's called Gamble, he approached me because I tried to get him a job and, of course, failed as normal. Mm. And he said, this was about 18 months, 2 years ago. He said, well, what he really wanted to do was write a TV series. So he and I have been writing together. And it's, his world and my world and where they overlap, which is crime, politics and sex. And he's really bright and I've never worked with anyone. I've never done fiction. So I'm finding it absolutely fascinating. We really work well together. Both of us are quite surprised about this. And it's, it's very interesting. I don't know whether it's going to get anywhere, but we're giving it a go.
Oh, wow. Well, good luck. I really look forward to seeing that.
Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being on Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. We'll be something else.